Paul Nixon, and today I'm with Gary Davis, Professor Gary Davis, who is Professor of Strategy at Manchester Business School. Gary, would you care to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the areas that your department cover in their research and so on?
Manchester Business School is quite a large institution, over 200 academics, and we have a number of specialist areas that we where a number of academics come together informally or formally. And the one that I head up is called the Reputation, Brand and Competitiveness Group. So there's a group within the business school, mainly doctoral students undertaking research, but also there's a larger, much larger informal group which stretches around the planet, again, mainly of ex-doctoral students who've now gone on to become academics in their own right. One or two practitioners, but our main purpose, I would say, is to research the area of corporate reputation, corporate branding, to publish in that. Yes, we do get involved in commercial projects, but usually to fund the activities that we're engaged in at the business school.
Let's start by talking about this. I mean, all of the questions are around reputation, and particularly from an online perspective, and which is very close to what our audiences are interested in. But let's start with talking about how you think reputation is measured, and what sort of key factors people take account of when assessing a company.
That's, I suppose, where we started with MBS nearly 10 years ago now, and in reputation management work. And that came out of some work that goes back even longer on branding in the retail sector. My background is Mars, so I learnt my branding in fast-moving consumer goods, and in particular confectionery, pet food, Uncle Ben's rice, Yeoman mashed potatoes.
Real stuff.
Real brands.
Yeah.
And the key was advertising. In fact, we had a mathematical model to determine what the budget should be. So I found myself then, a few years later, working in an academic environment and being involved with a number of retail companies in creating what was Britain's first degree in retailing. And one of the things I was very interested in teaching was branding in the context of retailing, because retailers were saying we're brands, and own brands were taking over really in many segments of the market. We started to realise that the name of the game in corporate branding was somewhat different from product branding. Eminent brands like Sainsbury were spending peanuts on advertising. Now, on earth can you be a brand without advertising? This seemed to me to be beyond the pale of understanding.
Just not right.
Just not right. And things like that then intrigue us as academic researchers. So how do brands get created? So roll on a few years, we're starting to recognise now that what we were discovering in the retail sector also applied to other service industries and service companies. And as 60% of managers now work for service organisations of one sort or another, many in the public sector, that seemed to be a fruitful area of research for a business school such as Manchester. The rules of the game then seem to be different. Advertising plays a much less prominent role. And we came across some research which seemed to indicate that there was a relationship between the employee view of reputation, the corporate brand, and the customer view. That intrigued us, but to get inside it, we needed a measure. Because I suppose as an ex-market researcher myself, I was interested in proof.
In God we trust, all others must bring data.
Absolutely right, absolutely right. And statistical tests are the mantra.
Yeah.
So, fine, we needed a measure of reputation. And we came across an approach from America, a lady called Jennifer Aker, daughter of a well-known branding guru called David Aker, and she'd come up with something that she'd called a brand personality test. And behind it all is the assumption that if you're thinking about a brand, you can, as an easy way to get inside what its image is or what its reputation is, you can start to pretend that it's a human being. And her trick was, as many people have done before, is to say, imagine, for example, that Manchester Business School has come to life as a human being. What would its personality be like? And she then devised this personality test. But most of her brands were product brands. The work was done in the States, and she focused on consumers rather than on employees.
Yep.
So our first task, it was a major piece of work, was to come up with our own measure of corporate reputation, which we call corporate character, which is basically a personality test applied to companies.
Mm.
And it's valid for both employees and customers, and it's been revalidated in 6 or 7 different languages and 10 or 15 different countries around the world. So we've now got a tool that we can measure this intangible thing, people's feelings, really, about something as ephemeral as a brand. So we can start to measure and challenge some of the statements that practitioners make about how to manage brands.
Mm. And this is an interview-based tool. You go out and
we can interview us. In the early days, it was 100% interviews. So we have a database, I think, something like 9,600 personal interviews.
Yeah.
Since then, we've started to wake up that we can use this tool online. We can use it via normal distributed questionnaires. So a lot of our work these days is done electronically.
Yeah. And so what, give us a flavour of some of those measures and some of those.
Well, like human personality, we found that it's multidimensional. So we have a dimension which looks very much like the human personality dimension of agreeableness. Is this person trusting, trustworthy? And exactly the same words then appear in the context of a firm. And maybe I'll step back a second, because this is important in terms of the understanding we have as to what this thing, reputation, represents. If I say that company X is trustworthy, I'm giving you two pieces of information. I'm telling you how I think that company will behave towards me in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also telling you how I think I will behave towards that company. And that's why it's so powerful. Because if I say that company is trustworthy, by implication I'm saying that everything that they tell me I can rely upon. I'm also telling you that I can rely upon them for their goods and services, and if they tell me something, I think it's going to be the truth. The transaction costs then between us are going to be lower, and I'm going to choose them over a company that might be a bit cheaper, but whose promises don't always seem to be kept, and whose approach to life seems to be a little bit more cavalier.
Yes.
So that's one aspect, and we have 7 of these dimensions, as we call them. The one that we often get to talk about is ruthlessness, controlling, arrogant, that sort of a more aggressive side of corporate personality. And when we did some work in Ireland a few years back, where we asked a number of focus groups to list their most ruthless companies. Top of the list was Ryanair. Number 2 was Microsoft. Number 3 was News International.
Yep.
Which led to a panorama program on Ryanair, where some of our work then helped shape that program. But that's a different story for a different day. That sounds a very negative aspect of corporate personality.
But some investors would see it as positive.
Oh, and managers see it as positive. Managers prefer to work for a company that's a tad ruthless.
Yep.
Focused. Employees don't like it. Customers don't like it. But they put up with it. Particularly as, in the case of Ryanair, they're offering you virtually free travel. In the case of Microsoft, you cannot avoid their products.
Yes. And what are the other key dimensions?
So it's competence, which is what it says it is, really. It's a measure of quality. And if you look at a lot of academic research, particularly from economists, they would say that that's what a brand does. It gives a signal of quality to the market. We found, though, that it doesn't seem to work. And our explanation is that, particularly at the corporate level, most people will be unwilling to deal, for very long at least, with a company that's incompetent. And those companies will exit the market fairly quickly. You might argue, tongue-in-cheek, that the public sector is still full of incompetent organisations, but we're stuck with those as well. So competence seems to be a hygiene factor. We want our, particularly the ones that are for profit, we want those to be competent. If they're not, we won't deal with them, they exit the market. But to tell me that such and such a company is twice as competent as I want it to be tells me nothing.
Yeah. It's a kind of gate, a qualifier.
It's a gate.
Yeah.
It's a threshold. Then there's chic, which is the sophistication. And this is interesting dimension, because we found that it works for food retailers such as Tesco, which you wouldn't necessarily associate with that aspect of corporate character. But if you compare Tesco today with where it was when both you and I were lads.
Oh, indeed.
It was pile it high and sell it cheap.
Yes.
And then along comes the CEO of McLaren that says, well, let's move these things out of town, let's move them into what at the time looked like temples of consumption. And let's push the business up market, but we'll keep that sort of price-driven message as well. Every little helps, as it is to this day. And therefore, we got Tesco, which appeals to both our sort of sense that we want a good deal, and at the same time, we want a place to shop that's that doesn't make us feel cheap. And that's the problem with the discount end of the market.
Yep.
In this country. Not abroad, but in this country, many people feel cheapened by shopping in the hard discounters, even though the data might indicate that they could save 30% on their grocery bill.
Just don't want to be seen there.
No, absolutely right. So you might go in. I think the beauty of Aldi and Netto and Lidl is that you can take your Marks and Spencer's bags in and fill them with the goods so that your neighbours don't realise what a cheapskate you really are.
I do remember my mother going to Harrods just to buy a tin of cat food and a large Harrods carrier bag.
A large bag. Yeah.
So that's, I think, three or four of them. How many? What other ones?
Well, there's seven. There's two. One that seems to, particularly this last Jennifer Aker that I mentioned earlier, seemed to be quite strong in her work. We both call it machismo. And it's sort of masculinity, it plays well with Latino cultures, and in fact in Spanish cultures it looks as if it might even be two dimensions. And that emphasises one aspect, that these main dimensions of corporate character seem to be pretty general. They'll work in most cultures, but there's one or two which are culturally specific, and this machismo one seems to be one of these. In Japan, for example, you can't tend to find that. And instead, you've got a dimension that some people call serenity, calmness. Particularly in the workplace, you don't lose your rag. If you want to tell your line manager what you think of him and her, you have to go out karaoke evening, both of you are drunk, and then you know everything is
sing okay. The appropriate song.
But you don't do it during work hours.
Yep.
So that's sort of net. That seems to fit anyway with our preconceptions of Japanese society. One other dimension which seems to work for some organisations, IKEA would be one, but we found that the fashion retailer New Look seems to be typified by this sort of sense of relaxed approach, casual, simple, easygoing. You know, the key words there. And there's a number of companies, particularly we felt coming into the new millennium, that might be quite a hot dimension. So even though it wasn't particularly well defined in our early work, we thought it would be useful then to carry on. Another big one is enterprise, and this is innovation.
Yes.
This is moving things around and changing things and coming up with new ideas. And it's an interesting one in its own right, in that employees don't like change. So if you want to be seen as an innovative culture, and if the employee view is key, then it sounds like a good idea then to have a culture which celebrates innovation, celebrates change, rather than one that finds it rather threatening.
Well, I guess, you know, people need a stable basis of at least one kind of dimension that's stable for their workplace. But, you know, you see the people who work at, whether it's Google or now Facebook, where there is new innovation and the whole of that industry thrives on coming up with new stuff.
Well, you used to work for Accenture, and if you didn't like change in a place like that, then find another career.
let's not talk about the scars just yet.